This podcast is brought to you by Church Society, a fellowship contending to reform and renew the Church of England in biblical faith. You'll find more information about Church Society and all the things that we do on our website, churchsociety.org. You'll also find there the full archive of the podcast. Welcome back to the Church Society podcast. I'm Ros Clark. I'm the Associate Director of Church Society. And once again, I'm here with Chris Moore, our Director for Wider Engagement, following our time at General Synod. So we're just going to have a chat about some of the things that went on at Synod, some of the debates we had, some of the decisions that were made, some of the debates that were paused and decisions that weren't made. And I'm also going to give you a little update at the end about the Standing Commission on the Five Guiding Principles that also met during Synod. Chris, there was a wide range of things on Synod agenda. There were 3 days of Synod before we even got towards living in love and faith. There were some debates where we made actual decisions. Could you maybe summarise things that particularly clergy will be most interested to know about? Parochial fees, clergy pensions, some of those sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. We did take decisions. We took decisions for funeral fees, crematorium fees. And you may remember, those of you who are church treasurers, you may remember at some stage when your vicar would go off and perform a service in a crematorium, you would receive a little bit of money for the time spent. And then that was taken from you. And the DBF, your boards of finance, hoarded it to themselves. Well, that's now coming back your way. So that was one decision that we took. Of relevance to clergy, we agreed to review the clergy pensions as well as the broader remuneration, the broader pay package, which has lagged behind inflation, but also has lagged because of decisions taken, well, a long time ago in the late, 2008, 2009, 2010, around that sort of time, where the church commissioners at that stage had lost a lot of money and was looking as if it's broke. It's now rolling in money. So now is the time to restore some of that balance. So those decisions were taken. And then these are good practical things that will affect, well, clergy, every pay packet at the end of every month, but parishes in terms of the income flow coming in. So there were some good decisions that were taken in the midst of everything. Synod is always a mixture of minutiae, tiny, tiny little decisions that do have an impact, and then huge, enormous decisions that have almost out of all proportion kind of impact upon us. So it's always a mixture of the large and the small, but we all stand and
absolutely
debate the rest of it.
I mean, very like a PCC meeting in some ways. You know, part of it will be, what colour are we going to paint the, you know, ladies' loos? And part of it will be, shall we spend £500,000 on a new building?
Imagine a five-day residential PCC meeting and you've got about there, yes.
Exactly. I mean, it's probably worth pointing out, if you are a clergy person listening to this, retired or otherwise, it won't make a difference to what appears in your pay packet this month. It will take a bit longer to work it all out.
Heels will be dragged.
Exactly. And, you know, it is complicated, but the goal has been set, and the chair of the Archbishop's Finance Committee is behind this, and all the systems are going to now work towards making that happen, and we hope sooner rather than later. So there were those sort of things. For us as lay people, one of the things that came up in a couple of different places was around codes of conduct, whether there should be codes of conduct for PCC members, whether there should be ways of dealing with bullying of clergy by lay officers. At the moment, there's the clergy discipline measure, which is obviously, you know, best known for its failings, and is, you know, there are attempts to be approving that, but there's no parallel redress for clergy who are suffering at the hands of lay people. You can't report them to anyone, and so they're just the beginnings of discussions about what a code of conduct might look like, what a sort of course of action might be, if you've got a lay officer who is causing bullying there. And also, actually, for us as General Synod members, so across the three houses, whether there should be some kind of code of conduct for General Synod members. I don't think we got very far in any of those. They would need to come back. But those discussions beginning to happen. We also had, which we always seem to have, some of which are actual motions, some of which are presentations, just giving our opinions on a whole range of different issues. We had land and nature, particularly biodiversity, future of work, looking at artificial intelligence, racial justice and whether there's been any progress on that in the church, families and households, the war in Ukraine, and evangelism on housing estates. Chris, was there anything in those debates that particularly struck you or points that you think we should have made that didn't?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I think it's worth perhaps the listeners knowing that not every member of General Synod stays sat in for every moment of General Synod. I'm afraid when it came to the future of work and for most of land and nature, I was absent from the chamber. So I'm sure many good points were made and things of great importance were made, but they passed me by. Estates evangelism is interesting. It's an opportunity for people to sort of tell their stories, so that's good. But also an acknowledgement that as a denomination, although we like to see ourselves as the established church and the church of the nation, we are quite narrow, really. Not everywhere, but we have a particular bias, it would seem to me, towards a leafier, middle-class kind of person. I mean, I was horrified that the estates evangelium wasn't about the country estates, which I have in my benefice, but rather about housing estates. So that was, you know, well, that was a monocle popper. So there's a kind of a sense that we're, you know, do we need to look at these things? Are we really reaching across all of our nation and representative to all of our nation? And of course, the debates around the reports on race, similarly, making that same point that we really, the gospel's for everybody in every corner. And we all, and we have, because of our established nature, because of our historic patterns, we have a particular bias in the Church of England towards our sort of traditional middle class constituencies, and that's not good enough, really.
Absolutely. And I think the point was made and well made that these things relate to each other, that if we're not doing a good job of reaching out to people of global majority heritage, that's probably related to the fact that we're not doing a good job of reaching out to inner city urban areas.
Yeah.
It's not a one-on-one correspondence, but nonetheless, those issues often go hand in hand. And it was really great, I thought, actually, in both of those debates to hear from so many people about their personal lived experience around this. And in particular, in the estates evangelism, a number of people giving maiden speeches who spoke very powerfully and very movingly about their journey to faith, about their journey to ministry, how hard that had been sometimes for people who'd grown up in disadvantaged circumstances in economically marginalised communities. I thought was a good way of describing how some of those people experience their lives. And absolutely, as a church, we need to do better. And there were good comments as well explaining some of the things which we are starting to do a bit better. So yeah, they were encouraging debates, even though there's clearly still much to be done. I think that's right.
I think that's true. I mean, I was struck when I, as you know, I was trained to be a Baptist minister. I was ordained as a Baptist minister. I was a Baptist for a number of years before returning to the Anglican fold, the warm embrace. And I was struck when I trained for ministry, I was the only person in my year who'd done A-levels. So people, everybody was doing a degree course, everybody was doing the same course, but there were access courses put in place to help people get there, a lot of support given. And, you know, that's not the experience I've seen in all Anglican colleges.
No, I think that's exactly right. So yeah, so I mean, that was one of the issues that was raised, was how are we thinking about different ways of discerning, but also then helping and supporting people with vocations? How are we thinking about doing evangelism that is not book based that doesn't depend on high levels of literacy, but also doesn't depend on English as a first language and doesn't depend on, you know, the sorts of things that we might take for granted.
And that links in as well to the clergy pay and pensions, because, you know, there almost seems to be an expectation that, well, when you retire, you'll live in the house that you inherited from daddy and all will be fine. And you know, that's not the experience that most clergy have. And there's that just sort of, they're barriers to entry, I suppose, is probably the best way of putting it for people into ministry. And so, you know, a lot of these things do come together. It's themes developed in that way.
Yes. No, I think that's completely right. I mean, there was a period when incredibly bad advice was given to people on getting ordained about selling their houses. But as somebody rightly pointed out, for many people these days in their 20s and 30s, the idea of buying a house is just, you know, not in their wheelhouse. And so then if you become ordained, that's great, you get somewhere to live, but you absolutely don't ever on a stipend get to a point where you can start thinking about getting a mortgage and investing in a house so you might have somewhere to retire to. There is a system for providing housing for retired clergy, but it is not great.
And it's being cut.
I think it's fair to say. Yeah. Exactly.
Cuts are being
made. Cuts are being made. And if you then are looking to a future where your pension is low, you've not had any opportunity really to build that up. So we heard a lot of really quite heartbreaking stories actually about some clergy struggling on their pensions. And it was good to hear those stories and to know that actually, if we do want people to be coming, as you say, from different kinds of backgrounds, we need to be making sure we are treating our clergy appropriately for the ministry that they give sacrificially. So, yeah, lots of those themes sort of come together. The first sort of substantive thing on our agenda was, as it so often is, safeguarding. Again, if you're on a PCC, you'll know that safeguarding is a regular feature of the agenda. At General Synod, it's mostly around, at the moment, the issue of the Independent Safeguarding Board. There was an Independent Safeguarding Board, briefly, I believe. That didn't go brilliantly. So what we had this time was a review of that 185-page report, and then another paper on the future of church safeguarding with various proposals. There was a lot of paperwork and we didn't get all of it very far in advance. So there were big discussions about whether we need to do something right now, whether we should give ourselves a bit more time to think about it. It's very fraught. I don't know whether you have any comments to add on that.
I think the church has got itself in a bind generally. I mean, there's a number of issues that seem to come together. One is the effectiveness of safeguarding itself. I mean, that at the nub of the issue, we want to be a church where it is safe for people to be. So that's one thing. And how's the best way that we can get to that? And then there's the other issue of, well, what do you do for those who have been failed by safeguarding in the past, the survivors of abuse? And so that becomes an issue. And then you get reputational damage, which seems to be an issue as well. So you want to protect your reputation in the wider world. And to be quite honest, it's reputational, seeking to preserve our reputation has got us into some of these problems in the first place. So you've got that sort of issue. And then you've got the two sort of responses to that. Well, one is that, well, we should set everything up as independently and as quickly as we can, and we should demonstrate by doing that that we really want to get a good solution, because independent must be best and sooner must be best. And then the other side of the argument would say we need to make sure that we look at this properly so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past when things were done in a bit of a rush. And is independent best, because might we just be seen to be throwing the problem to somebody else to sort out? So all these views are people who are trying to bring about the best result. Everybody's saying we need to have good, effective safeguarding, but there's disagreements about the best route to get to that sort of end.
Yes, exactly. And disagreements about what independence actually means. So for some people, if your independent safeguarding board is funded by the Archbishop's Council, for example, well, then it's not independent. OK, but I don't know who else you think is going to pay for it. These things are not cheap.
Yeah.
You know, money has to come from somewhere. And it seems to me the church ought to be paying for church safeguarding. OK, so then you end up in this sort of impasse in, you know, and that sort of thing happens in all sorts of ways around this issue. And it is not straightforward at all.
And I think part of the issue as well, and the longer you sit on General Synod, the more you realise this, is that the Church of England is in effect a network of all sorts of different bodies. Some have power, others have money. Very few seem to have power and money together. The Church of England sort of doesn't exist. It's just a collection of, you know, 40-odd dioceses. That's really the Church of England. So can you do anything nationally when there isn't really a national body? And all of these sort of historic structures that we've inherited all play into this problem, because very often there's not one person who can carry the can. And that's, again, it's part of this issue. We're too complicated as an organisation.
We are not going to discuss the governance review, but it is a complicated question which is being looked at. Is are there ways of simplifying those kind of structures and so on? The subject of marriage came up in several places this time. We had a discussion, a motion around the Archbishop's Commission on Families and Households. They produced a report called Love Matters a year or so ago. It's been a little bit complicated as to why it's taken so long for that to come for discussion at Synod. The report is okay. It's pretty bland. I don't think it says anything particularly useful that we don't already know. So we were supposed to be just sort of welcoming the report and maybe it was going to be used. But I think there's already better material out there, probably. One amendment was brought to reaffirm the value of marriage, especially when loving, as providing the most stable and permanent environment for bringing up children. You know, there is actual data on this, that children thrive best if they're in stable families where the parents are married to one another. It wasn't a particularly hot debate. There was somebody who spoke against the amendment, but in quite a careful and cautious sort of way. But the amendment was voted down. I think probably people were voting against it for a number of different reasons. Do you think that would be fair to say, Chris?
I think that's true. And I think as well, there's within all of these debates we're having at the moment, because, and I know we're going to come to LLF a little bit later on, the whole issues surrounding LLF pop up in all sorts of different places, and suddenly you find that what you thought was a helpful amendment to reaffirm the place of marriage somehow in people's minds generally becomes part of this LLF debate. And because we're not going to be able to vote on it over there at that part of Synod, we're going to have a proxy vote on it over here, and we're going to show our dismay by voting this down. And you suddenly find that, I mean, I was in the tea room when this debate started, and I was listening to it because you've got a huge screen, big, enormous screen in the tea room. And the idea is you sit, you take tea, and you look at seeing what's going on, and then you're keeping up to date. And suddenly I thought, gosh, I'm going to have to get back into the chamber here, because I can see this vote's not going to be, you know, as uncontested as I thought it might be. But you don't really know in advance. And you think, well, is it because of it's taken by somebody, it's brought by somebody who would be seen to be on one side of LLF? Or I don't know. These things then suddenly will blow up. And I spent a fair bit of that debate sort of scrambling, trying to find the voting machine and get into the chamber.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was an amendment that was welcomed by the bringer of the motion. So every amendment, the person who's proposing the motion has the opportunity to say whether they welcome the amendment or resist the amendment. And often that will sort of steer the tone of the following debate. I think it was the Bishop of Durham who was proposing this, welcomed the amendment. And yet even then, it Yeah, I think you're right. For some people, this was a sort of proxy vote. For some people, it was a, genuinely felt thing that we can't say one kind of family is better than any other kind of family. And for some, that will be a very personal thing. But it, I was surprised that it became quite so controversial and was voted down. But we also had a debate, I think there was the last business in Synod, around divorce and remarriage. And I know you spoke in this debate. What was it that was being proposed, Chris?
When, for all sorts of various historic reasons, you will be well aware that the Church of England, for most of its history, would not remarry divorcees in church. And then the rules were changed. And as part of these issues and a part of all the debates, the question comes, well, what do we do with clergy who either themselves are divorced or who are married to divorcees whose partners are still alive, or ex-partners, I should say, are still alive. And this gave rise to what's known as the C4 faculty. And the C4 faculty says that, look, if somebody's come for ordination who themselves is divorced or is married to a divorcee, they then need to go through a particular process where the circumstances of that marital breakdown of either the ordinand or the person to whom they're married is investigated. In many instances, the previous spouse may well be contacted. Then evidence is given to the archbishops, who then sign a faculty to allow that to happen. And it happens in broadly a sixth of all ordinations. The ordinand will fall into that kind of category. So the proposal that came was to say, look, this is nuts, because this is such a high proportion of people and it's taking up archbishops' time. It's a very slow process because archbishops have got other things to do rather than look at this and sign paperwork. And we need to get rid of it. But the problem was, is that it wasn't really saying what should come up in its place. And so very easily you could see that this would be a way of simply saying, do you know what, you know, divorce doesn't really matter that much, and let's just get over that whole permanency of marriage business and crack on. So I did speak, because I was a little, well, more than a little concerned that we, again, this might be, along with what we'd said, or hadn't said about marriage in the families debate earlier, I thought this could be another sort of kicking for carrot for marriage. But then something rather interesting happened, that it was Mark Bennett, Canon Mark Bennett of the Diocese of Oxford, who brought the original motion, who would be in the Liberal camp. And he was contacted when this motion came to light and was accepted to be debated by Andrew Atherston, who I'm sure many listening will know, who is at Wycliffe, teaches at Wycliffe
He's
Hall.
Been on the podcast before, yes.
Indeed, our good friend Andrew Atherston. And he basically met with Mark and spent a long time working with him. And yes, they've got big differences, but they, on this issue, they worked together. And an amendment came up from Andrew that basically said, well, we won't require a faculty from the archbishops, but instead it can be granted by the bishop. So that, of course, spreads the workload. It makes the decision being taken at a much lower level, the doctrine of subsidiarity, and seemed a sensible way through. It was warmly received by Mark Bennett, who commended it, as you said, Roz, that, you know, those bringing the motions can either support or oppose the amendment. He even described it as a gift from God. So there was an extraordinarily warm reaction. And then the amendment was carried, I think either unanimously or nearly unanimously. And given the fact what we'd seen about marriage earlier, I was, you know, with the rejection of that amendment, I was quite surprised. But it's a good example, I think, that when both sides, and I know we're not supposed to be party political, but we kind of are, but when both sides work together, it's almost so unusual that people get excited and yes, let's vote for that, almost as much to say not only are the issue of divorce, but the very fact we've managed to come up with a solution between us, and we've not managed that anywhere else.
I agree it was quite something. I wasn't in the room for this debate. I was watching some of it on the tea room, and then I had to leave, but I it felt quite unusual in the way that it goes. We have plenty of debates where our votes are very nearly unanimous or entirely unanimous when we're saying things like the war in Ukraine is bad and that
apple pie is good.
We often can agree on that. But for this issue, as you say, where they have begun with quite different views, to hear not just the kind of Mark Bennett receiving that amendment so warmly, but actually the Archbishop of York himself also welcoming it so enthusiastically. I must admit, I had not realised that both archbishops had to sign all the faculties. No. I thought they split it between them. But, you know, it really was a ridiculous system. They couldn't possibly know the individuals and their circumstances, whereas a diocesan bishop can at least arrange to have a meeting with somebody if they, you know, and can make a more informed decision. So it just made sense to everybody, I think, to make the system better, but then without needing to change any of, you know, our doctrine or our practice around that doctrine substantively. So it was a really great end to synod, I think, actually, to have that outbreak of unexpected unity. It can't really be said that the debate which we had on LLF resulted in an outbreak of unexpected unity, even though the very final vote that was taken there was, if not unanimous, you know, a substantial majority. I think, you know, 300 and something in favour and 69 against at the end. It was an interesting motion, I think. That was one of the things. It was a different sort of motion than we've had previously, and therefore a different sort of debate. Although some of the speeches that we heard were around same-sex relationships, as you would expect, that wasn't really the point at issue. So, Reverend Martin, what is he? He's a bishop, isn't he?
Bishop
Martin Snow, who'd sort of been left carrying the can on his own after Helen Ann Hartley stepped down from her role as lead bishop, presented a paper, fairly lengthy paper with a number of annexes and at its heart 10 commitments, to which was sort of supposed to set a kind of framework by which the LLF process would continue to move forward. But it was quite vague, so we weren't really voting on whether those were the commitments we wanted to make, just whether we sort of liked the vague idea of commitments. A number of the commitments talked about settlement, and so there was some debate about what settlement might involve, some debate about whether, just not very much debate about whether these were the right kind of commitments to be having. But actually, it was a slightly different kind of debate, and in general conducted in a relatively calm manner, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there was, I think, the motion originally came out, now it was, I suspect, supposed to come originally from our two bishops who are co-leading on LLF, but as there was only one remaining co-bishop, it came just in the name of the Bishop of Leicester. And the problem with this is that you've got these two co-bishops supposed to be representing each side of the debate, and of course when you've only got one, the side of the debate that's not represented are immediately suspicious about anything that's going to be put in. And so the bishop then circulated to all the members of General Synod a kind of letter in which he said, well, it reminded me a bit of the old joke of Groucho Marx, these are my principles, and if you don't like them, well, I've got other ones. You know, it was a sense of, well, we're not sure what you're committing to, what these are going to be, and the commitments then just became suggested commitments. And I think it was pretty clear early on, all the way through Synod, that there was going to be this move to next business motion. We'll come back to that. We'll explain that. We will come back to that.
Yes, we will.
And so the heat was taken out of the debate. So we were sort of thinking, well, we're not quite sure what we're debating here, because it's all so vague and woolly. It's going to become irrelevant probably in an hour or two anyway. And so there were some amendments that were brought, which were debated, not all of them, but most of them. It would appear that Andrew Corns appears to be kryptonite to many, and so people don't want to discuss anything he might say because the Corns amendment is now notorious. So we had some discussion, and there was a little bit of agreement even there. We all agreed. We passed an amendment that said that we don't welcome this report, but we note it. That's quite a significant change, really, because it's showing that we don't welcome it. So that was and then another one saying, but we did welcome the fact that there's some more transparency from the bishops. Hooray for that. We also said...
There was a lovely moment where Neil Paterson of the Baron Paterson motion, which was one of the sort of early attempts to move towards a debate on same-sex marriage, Neil Paterson stood up to speak in support of Jane Paterson, who is church society member, CEC person, Leeds Eggs, all this sort of thing, who proposed her amendment around honesty and transparency. And it was great to have a moment where we agreed with each other.
A brace of Patersons, something. Yes.
I know, exactly. Go on.
But one thing which we didn't agree, again, it's probably worth our... our listeners knowing that there was another amendment which Charlie Screen brought, basically saying we can't say that we agree to disagree on this because there is a party in Synod who are against, a party who are in favour of LLF, but another party who sort of sits somewhere in the middle was saying, well, we're not particularly in favour of this, but we think it's a secondary issue. We don't think it's that important. The sort of let's agree to disagree kind of party. Now, that was defeated, but it was defeated in a split vote. It was reasonably close. So that was almost demonstrating the fact that we can't agree to disagree, even though we've just voted down a motion that says we can't agree to disagree. But in so doing, we proved the point.
Yes, I think that was Ed Shaw's amendment, not Charlie Screen's.
Oh, was it? I beg your pardon. Yeah.
No, that's fine. And that's right. It was quite interesting to see people sort of talking themselves into knots, disagreeing with the fact that some of us can't agree to disagree, but having to disagree in order to do that.
And we failed to agree that we can't agree to disagree. Yes,
exactly. And we sort of proved the point to those of us who can think logically about such things. So you're right. And then Charlie's amendment was building on the idea that if we can't agree to disagree, we're going to need to at some point get to a point where we can find a way forward to agree on, and suggesting that we consider starting to look at structural provisions for it. Unsurprisingly, that was voted down, I think. Mm. So we have those four amendments that were debated. You don't usually get long debates over amendments. Geoffrey Tattersall, who's chaired all of the LLF debates, was chairing this one as well. And he generally will allow, a few speeches on either side for an amendment and then call for a motion for closure. We had a lot fewer amendments this time, thankfully. So things did move on. But there was a fifth amendment proposed by Andrew Corns. And before we could get to that amendment, somebody called for a point of order and asked that we move to next business. Now, Andrew Corns' amendment was asking that we take time to consider more carefully the theological, pastoral and legal issues at hand. It would seem to me that that's a good thing for us to do. You know, we have not, for example, in the life of this synod, this quinquennium, had any debate that looks at the biblical material around same-sex relationships. We've heard some vague things, and there was more in the paper this time about what some of the legal advice has been and the legal risks. But we've not really been able to debate whether those are risks that we think are worth taking or whether, they could be mitigated in some way. We've not really had a lot of chance, although we've spent more time on this part, to think through the pastoral implications. What would it mean, for example, for a minister in a multi-parish benefice where there are very different opinions on this? Or, what if we commended standalone blessings, but then they were voted down under a later motion? Those sorts of things. So that's what the Corns amendment this time was asking for. But as I say, before we got to that, we had the call for next business. I felt as though when we were told the call for next business was not intended to be partisan, that may or may not have been true, but it felt to me that calling for it at that point, rather than allowing the last of the five amendments to be debated, felt possibly partisan and certainly quite rude, actually, to say we're not even going to listen to your amendment, Andrew Corns. We did have the motion for next business, and it was voted for overwhelmingly. What happens now? What does it mean that we voted for next business?
If you vote for next business, it's a way of Synod sort of entirely rejecting the basis of what's come on. So you can't bring back within the life of that sort of 5 year, because we were elected for 5 year patterns, you can't bring back in the life of that 5 year synod the same proposal, or a proposal that is substantially the same. The only exception to that is that the business committee, if it's deemed to be in the best interests of synods, can allow that to happen, but that's very much meant to be an exception. So, and it's a mechanism by which, I suppose, in a way, you'd want to say that Synod as a whole can show its disdain over what was brought. This is so far off the mark that you just come back and try something different. So the message sent is that whatever the answer may be, this isn't it. It's a reasonably nuclear option, but it's,
I think,
one
that's right.
Yeah,
it's not, I think, quite as severe as what had happened back in, I think, 2017, when Synod voted not to take note of what the bishops had proposed. I mean, that's what potentially could have happened if we'd gone on to have the rest of the debate and then voted on the motion. We could have refused to take note of this. And I think that's an even more serious message that the Synod can send. I think this is one step back from that. But as you would say, it's a way of saying none of us think this is the right way to deal with this.
I think, yeah, you're right. I think the nuance perhaps in this is that the proposal to move to next business was brought by somebody on the liberal wing of the argument. Now, if it had proceeded to a vote, I think there was enough in the proposal that would have been anathema to the liberal wing of the church, that they would have wanted to have voted it against it. They couldn't vote in favour of it. On the evangelical wing wouldn't have voted in favour of it. So it would have been voted against, and there would then be the risk, if you're thinking in the liberal wing of the church, the risk that the whole thing would just grind to a halt. There is now, we've stalled and that's it. This is a way of rejecting the proposals, but not saying the whole thing has come, because we just want to carry on, but just don't want this. We don't like this
idea. I think that's exactly right. I mean, Miranda Thruffle Holmes, who brought that motion, you know, she said, I would have had to vote against this. And I think there were many who would have felt the same. And we certainly would have felt the same. And so it was extremely likely that the motion itself would have been voted against, which would have caused even more serious ructions. As it is, where things stand, we've got one lead bishop left, who talked about trying to gather together a group of bishops to take this forward rather than just another lead bishop. If they want to bring proposals for something in July, they will have to get that to the business committee sometime in May. We're now almost in March, so that gives them a couple of months, which includes Easter, to gather together a new group and to come up with new proposals that look sufficiently different from these proposals that the business committee say, yeah, we'll try that. I think at this point, if they brought something similar to the business committee would rightly say the same thing is going to happen. You know, they will absolutely need to take note that it needs to be very different in what it looks like. And I don't know whether they have time to do that, to get something together by May that can get onto the agenda for July for us to debate. We wait and see. We really pray earnestly that we do not have to have another November synod. But in that case, it could be that we're looking at this time next year before anything else can move forward. So we don't know. I think my feeling is we haven't made anything worse in the last week. I don't know that we've made anything better, but I don't think
pension a lot better.
I don't think we've made anything worse with respect to the prayers of love and faith in the next week. And that may well be as good as an outcome as we could possibly have hoped for. Do you have any final things to say on that?
Just on that. I just think, to be quite honest, Rod, it's showing what was brought to us, the way it was received, is just really showing that this is quite an impossible situation. I mean, to try and square this circle, I mean, the Pandora's box has been opened, we can't close it again, and everything is out there, the divisions are deep set, and how they're going to find a way through this, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Just briefly then, to let you know what's going on with the Standing Commission for the Five Guiding Principles. We are continuing to meet. Our workload is increasing to some extent, so we potentially will be meeting a bit more in the future. The College of Bishops had some discussions at their recent meeting. It's 10 years, obviously, since the consecration of women bishops happened, so they were having a sort of general review of that. One of the things that came out was those who had not been through the debates in 2013, which led to the formulation of the Five Guiding Principles on Mutual Flourishing, didn't feel the same sense of ownership of them, didn't feel the same commitment to them, were maybe thinking these are something which needs to start lapsing. So one of the tasks that we have been given as the Commission actually is to be thinking of ways in which the story can be retold, that people can be educated to understand why they are so essential, what that might look like in theological colleges, in IME, but also, you know, as clergy are progressing through, you know, if you're an archdeacon, thinking through what it might mean for you to really be committed to the Five Guiding Principles in that new role. Or if you become a suffragan or a diocesan bishop, you know, how do you understand how to implement the Five Guiding Principles in those sorts of roles? So I think that was a good outcome from a slightly nervous kind of, you know, might these be disappearing? Well, actually, no. And we are really committed to making sure that future generations in the church understand them and remain committed to them. There are other pieces of work that we are looking into as well. Thinking about some lessons to be learned and good practice for consecration of complementarian bishops, producing some general guidance/guidelines for dioceses to put in place, some of which will arise out of the work we've previously done on the London Plan and some which will be more general than that. So there's lots of good things happening. At every one of our meetings is an opportunity to share examples that we've seen of good practice or of bad practice. So I do encourage you to get in touch with me if you have any of those stories that you'd like me to share in those meetings. Thank you very much for listening. The podcast will be back next week. I can't remember what's going to be about, but I'm sure it will be fascinating listen as always. Thank you so much, Chris, for your service on General Synod and for sharing your reflections on it with us this time.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Church Society podcast. You can find the whole podcast archive on our website, churchsociety.org. Don't forget to subscribe to us on your usual podcast app, and we'd love it if you are able to leave a review or give us a rating over there as well. Thank you.